Welcome to Reinventing Nerds. Dr. Joni Cannell shares communication strategies for technical people. She shares her own stories of learning to communicate and brings in other nerds and experts to show you how to interact with people in a way that's comfortable for you. And now, here's your host, the uniquely qualified engineer-turned-psychologist, Dr. Joni Cannell.
Hello and welcome to Reinventing Nerds. Today we have a really unique guest and story, and I want to tell you a little bit about our guest. He is Michael Pulde, and he runs Pulde Resiliency Partners. He focuses on reducing business and IT risk, and he has a great story that he's going to share with us that's very relevant to all the rest of the nerds on the podcast. And I want to just keep it short because the story speaks for itself. Let's just welcome today Michael Pulde. Welcome, Michael. Hi.
Hi.
It's great to see you and
great
hear
to
you.
See you too. Great to see you too. Thanks for having me today.
Yeah. You know, I kind of want to dive right in because you have this great story, and your career was really accelerated for the first 25 years. I mean, you worked in a lot of different industries. You worked in governments, aerospace, banking, security services, startup, and also at IBM. And then you came to a full stop, as you told me. And yeah, you lost your first wife to suicide. I'd really appreciate it if you could walk us through your professional mindset and focus around that time. I think it was around 2009. Tell us more about that.
Well, yeah, it was pretty tragic, and that tragic is a really underwhelming word mm-hmm. for what my life was going through. I was essentially a pretty successful business technical executive at IBM, fast track, doing lots of really great, exciting things. I had two global jobs at the company. I had lived in a number of places around the United States, and I was running a business within IBM. We were doing roughly $100 million a year, which at IBM it's a small company.
Yeah.
Great profit growth, great client growth. It was really a turnaround situation within the company. Mm-hmm. And I was just going flat out, full speed. And I was focused on the career, and my wife at the time, she's focused on the family and the house and all the actions that make that happen. And we used to joke, I was the CEO and she was the COO that really did all the work and made all the decisions. And I just mm-hmm. brought in a paycheck and went along for the ride. And I was actually on a trip, business trip, and I got a phone call from a number of people, but I was in the meeting. I didn't really answer my phone. And then I started picking up messages, and one of the messages was from the coroner in the city of Boulder, Colorado, where we lived. And obviously that was a pretty significant message to receive from the coroner. And my initial thought was something had happened to our kids. And then I spoke to the coroner and he explained what happened, and it was very shocking to say the least. And I pretty much dropped everything and hopped on an airplane. And quite frankly, I pretty much cried the entire flight back.
Yeah, I bet.
It was unbelievable. And we went through, one of my sons was in college at the time at the Arizona State. So I had to fly him back to Colorado. My other two boys were in high school. Fortunately, we had a close family friend that watched over them until I got back. And that's pretty much how it started. And I still, to this day, 12 years later, still remember that whole sequence of events very, very vividly. From the time I was called to going to the airport, I had a great assistant at the time who really helped me navigate a lot of things so I could get home, so my son in Arizona could get home. And that pretty much from that moment on, I started my second life.
Yeah. Wow. So, I mean, you were just like on fire in your corporate life and probably your home life too. And suddenly whammo, like everything changed. And yeah, that's just a lot to deal with all at once. And then you said you have a second life here. I mean, how did you turn around? I mean, you look here, you said your second life is a little bit about your disaster recovery career. And you do continuity and incident planning, crisis management. You know, how did that come out of this?
Yeah, that's it was actually a very interesting segue into what was actually happening to me personally, because as you mentioned, I've spent most of my career, well, really all of my career in technology, but most of my career has been in the area of handling crisis situations, critical mm-hmm. situations, helping others, mostly businesses, but helping others plan for disasters. Because if you have a plan and something bad happens, you have a much better chance in surviving that disaster. Well, the comment that I was making to myself and was saying to some of my friends was, well, I'm now dealing with my own critical situation.
Right.
Because quite frankly, you don't really plan for things like this. It doesn't happen to you. Fortunately, we did have some estate planning, which very much helped get through a lot of the legal elements to that. So that was huge. But having a really, once that I started returning back to understanding what was going on in my life, I was able to go ahead and start pushing out a program for how to recover and how to rebuild my life. Mm-hmm. And it was using a lot of the techniques that I had learned in business, but applying those to me personally. So I'll give you some examples.
Yeah.
Finding good mentors to help. I leaned very heavily with a therapist for several years, and I had my children involved in therapy for at least 12 months. And I told them after 12 months, they can do whatever they want. But for the first 12 months, they're going into therapy. They all three of them, I'll jump kind of to the end here. All three of them, they have very healthy, happy lives. They're doing very well in their careers. They have successful relationships. And I attribute that to those first 12 months. And getting them into the right care. Second was building a team. So I built a team to help me navigate through my personal crisis. And that team consisted of around five or six people, a few of them family, a few of them were friends or coworkers. And that team was really a group of people that I could count on and I could call anytime. It was my 24/7 support line.
So you said some of these teams were coworkers, some of them were family and friends. I mean, how did you select your team?
Well, it's very interesting. You know, I know I'm sure a number of your listeners have had their own personal crisis and what you find and what most people find is some people that you expect to be there are there, and some people that you expect to be there are not there. Mm-hmm. And then people that you never thought you'd have any relationship at all of a sudden show up. And, yeah. and that's what happened to me is it was this interesting cascade of individuals that would come in or left my life. Mm-hmm. And from that group, I was able to put together the right set of people.
Well, one of the things I just wanted to highlight, I mean, especially for the listeners, is, I mean, what you're saying is that you took your sort of vocational training to help you manage this crisis and give you your second life. But also, there were people from work who were there for you personally. And, you know, sometimes just for the nerd listeners here, that they don't always think about blending that or, you know, talking to people about personal things, but realizing that how much that can help you both professionally and personally when you have folks at work who you can trust and be on your team inside and outside of work, it really helps. So I just thought that those were both really important points that you had brought up that I want to make sure were clear to the folks who are listening in and viewing. Yeah.
Yeah. To that point, it was really quite amazing. I had my inner circle of people mm-hmm. that I really depended on. And then I had my professional colleagues that mm-hmm. some of them I was closer with than others, but they really stepped up too, because my original thought, again, I'm very type A and very success oriented. This was only going to be a 3-week speed bump.
Oh, wow.
You know, I'll be back going in 3 weeks.
Yep.
Well, 3 weeks came and I went back to work and I was like, I can't do this. Mm-hmm. I mean, my kids went back to school within a week. They're like, Dad, we want to go back to school. We want to get back into sports. I mean, the schools were great. They were like, mm-hmm. don't worry, your kids will pass all their classes. We will make sure that they are fine, which was mm-hmm. really helped a lot. It really took a lot of big burden off of my mind. But for me, the people at work almost did the same thing. Mike, just show up. Work is whatever you can put in is fine. Mm-hmm. You know, we'll take care of this. And so for a year, I pretty much would phone it in. I'd answer a few emails if I could. There was a lot of times I could not even get through a meeting without breaking down and crying. And obviously that's not the professional experience you want to exude when you're negotiating mm-hmm. a $50 million mm-hmm. 5-year contract with a client. So I was no good in any business setting at all. And having that group of people to really help me and support me, it was quite amazing. And I think giving people the opportunity to do that, which I did, because I really, quite frankly, I didn't even push back on it. And I think that's what helped. People really just stepped up because they were given the opportunity to do so.
Mm-hmm. Well, that must be a testament to your leadership previous to that as well. If you can have people who are empowered to do that. But also I think realizing that you're not, that people can get on without you if need be, I think is huge, especially for leaders. Sometimes they just think that they have to be there no matter what, and that you took care of yourself. I mean, this is one of the reasons why it's so important for people to hear your story, is that when life throws you a curveball like this and you're just really taken out for a while, it is important to take care of yourself and navigate through. So, but you made a very dramatic change, and we keep talking about your second life here, and we're sort of, going around it. But I'd like to know, what did you do? You know, what was, and how did you come to this conclusion? I'm not going to give it away. I mean, maybe I should here. So, you started to work with suicide survivors and the Dede Hirsch mental health community in Los Angeles. So tell us a little bit about that, how you came to work with them and what you do now.
Well, first of all, it took a long time for me to get to that point where I could where I could really help others. I mean, we're talking 8 years, mm-hmm. 9 years. I would, through my processes, I got stronger and I would meet other suicide survivors, other people who lost a loved one. I recognize the value that it really had for me to tell my story. Mm-hmm. And I also recognize that the more I told my story, even to people that weren't necessarily survivors, but people that were depressed or they mm-hmm. had a loved one who was depressed. And when I would tell them what happened to me and happened to my family and how I navigated through it, I realized it helped them find solutions to their personal situations.
Did Dede Hirsch help you? Was that one of the places you turned to, or did you get help other places?
No. I got help from other places. Okay. By the time I came to Los Angeles, I moved to Los Angeles in 2015. So it was roughly 6 years after the loss of my first wife. And when I came to Los Angeles, as I started integrating myself into the community, because I came here and I knew like 3 people, I found that, again, my passion for helping others deal with their depression or dealing with suicide loss, even though I'm not a trained therapist, I don't profess myself being a trained clinical therapist, but I have this personal experience, which fortunately people relate to. And because of that, I sought out the D.D. Hirst community and found out they had a survivors of suicide program.
Okay.
And through that, meeting the people that run those programs, they integrated me actually very quickly into a as a co-facilitator for group therapy sessions. And for me personally, I'm probably in probably 16 to 24 weeks a year now, I'm spending time with people who have lost a loved one to suicide.
Wow. So tell us about that. I mean, yeah, what is it that you do?
It's very heavy. First of all, I get a lot of personal satisfaction out of it because by telling my story, even though it's been over a decade, it gives a lot of people hope. And when I look back, what was going through my mind the first year, the first 2 years, I desperately looked for people who had already experienced what I had gone through. And so I could find out, what are those guideposts? What should I be doing? Everyone's journey, first of all, is their own individual personal journey. My journey is not someone else's. But by communicating my journey, there's certain commonalities that people get when they're in this very awful, exclusive club. Now, when I'm in these meetings, in these group therapy sessions, I mean, it's very heartbreaking because there's so much loss and there's so much pain that people are experiencing. And it's also a very sad testament to what is going on around not just the United States, but worldwide as it relates to mental health and depression and even gun violence. And I'm not going to put my political position on firearms, but I will specifically state, when I go to these meetings, the high percentage of people who have lost a loved one due to a gunshot. I was in this one session, there were 8 women, all of them lost a husband, child, father, or friend due to a gunshot. Everyone. And that statistic is not unusual. It's suicide by guns is very high. And I think the base statement is if someone is having any type of mental depression, or there's even a feeling that someone is feeling their personal safety is at stake, get the guns out of the house.
Well, you know, I just wanted to jump to today for a second, because that's very poignant. I mean, with the pandemic and so much has been going on, the depression statistics, you know, it's really up. Depressive disorder in the first 6 months of 2019 and 2021, it skyrocketed from 11 to 41%, right? As some numbers that you've actually helped me identify. And the Kaiser Family Foundation had a survey, and they said that a lot of the mental illness in adults is without a job or an income loss. And there are a lot of people feeling suicidal. So this is really important, you know, with guns around the house, that people might have access to a method, which is, I mean, in my psychology training, that was always a very important point. Do you have, you know, an access to a method? And what goes through your mind, though, when you read these kind of statistics?
Well, quite frankly, it's very scary. In fact, I was on the phone today with a woman who I just recently met in, she's based in, outside of Belgium. And we actually got on this particular topic of depression and how during the pandemic, the mental outlook of individuals all over the globe, how it's really gotten bad. And a lot of it is because people are in their homes with nothing to do. I mean, mm-hmm. they may be working or they may be reading or you know, making banana bread, but at some point they have nothing to do. And that's where it goes back to people that don't have any strategies on getting out of the house or getting exercise or having a routine. And when you fall out of those things, the mind has a tendency to take you into a place where ultimately it leads to an area of depression. And again, I'm not a professional here, but mm-hmm. everything that I've read and talking to people, this is what goes through my mind, is that it's so easy to just let go and not be in the routines and not exercise on a daily basis and not find a way to go outside. And, the more that people are hibernating, the worse it seems to continue to get.
Yeah. I was actually just having a conversation with somebody about this last week, and they were saying that even though it's possible we're going to be getting out of the pandemic and we might be being able to be in person more, still people are at that level, the stress level from this past year and a half, where even the littlest thing could be a trigger to push us over and how to get out of the depression that we might be feeling. So this is going to be a long-term concern that we have. I wanted to ask you some follow-up questions here, and I hope you'll indulge me. We started out by talking about your work and you being a nerd and, working at IBM and security and risk management and all that. I'm just really curious about how you made that transition to be able to talk about your feelings and your vulnerabilities and all of this. I mean, you've mentioned a couple times here on this podcast that you cried, and you don't hear that very often from people, people at work and all that. And I'm just, the fact that you're able to say this, I wanted our listeners to learn how you were able to do that.
Well, again, this is not something that happened overnight. Mm-hmm. It was I feel very fortunate that I came from a family that was actually a very loving family. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of, open communications and support. So I think that was something that was very, very big and important for me. I think that I mentioned therapy. Mm-hmm. I had periods of my life where the marriage may not have been going so well, or I had personal relationship problems. In fact, I remember in college, which was the first time I ever saw a therapist, because I was depressed. I was a computer science major. I was editor of the yearbook. I did all this photography. I mean, I was very, very active socially and very active in a very difficult major. And I lost it, quite frankly. And I went and saw a therapist for the very first time in college. And that was actually a really great experience for me. Mm-hmm. I got some very good counseling from this gentleman. And I probably only went maybe four or five times. It wasn't a lot, but it was enough to really kind of help me. And from that point forward, as I would go through more experiences in my life, quite frankly, I was open to going to seeing a therapist. Now, it wasn't like every time I needed to see a therapist, it was the same person. And sometimes I met therapists that were not so good. Mm-hmm. And so there's a little bit, it's like dating,
some
people are great and some people are not. And you have to essentially be able to make the call for yourself. So I think that really helped. And then the other big turning point was really after the loss of my wife. And I fought it. Like I said, I fought the emotions. Like, mm-hmm. I'm going back to work after 3 weeks. Mm-hmm. I'm not a failure. I can persevere through this. I can find a way to get through it. Well, within 3 months, I realized I'm not going to find my way through this. It's not going to happen. So the analogy I came up with was, I'm like a stick on the river, and I'm just floating down the river. And I have no control over where I'm going. the river controls, the river will control my path. Mm-hmm. And so the only thing I can do is just sit back and enjoy the ride. And so if I was going to cry, I'm going to cry. Mm-hmm. If someone who I felt wasn't supportive of me, then I wasn't going to spend a lot of time investing in that individual. In fact, there was a number of people that are no longer in my life anymore, professionally and personally, mm-hmm. because of the lack of empathy and support for myself and my children. And doing those two things, really, you know, the realization that don't fight it, let your emotions come out. It'll help the grieving process. It'll help your recovery process, and it'll help you get yourself back into a state of mind that you can focus on your job and your family and yourself. And I said those actually in reverse order. You know, you have to be able to support you have to be able to, you know, take care of yourself before you can help your family and your kids, and before you can help your career. And so that was the approach I took.
So, tell us about your life now, and perhaps a little bit about your work and your volunteer work.
Sure. So as I mentioned, I now live in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. I've been remarried, and I have a wonderful, happy life living near the beach outside of Los Angeles. Between the two of us, I have three children from my first marriage. She has two, so we have five boys.
Wow.
So that's a lot of fun. They're all roughly in the same age demographic, so that's mm-hmm. great. But we have a great time together, and it's been that I've been able to have a lot of fun enduring the pandemic. Mm-hmm. With. So that's been great. Professionally, I now run my own company, where we focus on helping companies avoid and mitigate disasters. Mm-hmm. Or crisis, whether it's an employee safety situation, an IT disaster, a business process issue, organizationally, you know, in terms of understanding risk. So we help companies understand risk, understand what's the most important thing to their business, and how do they keep it running when extreme things happen.
Right. You know,
for example, the state of Texas.
Oh, right.
Five days without power, you know, that'll never happen. You know, so how many people took any action after the Texas power outage to make sure they can run themselves and make sure they can run their home office or their business office? Very, very, unfortunately, very few people have taken any actions. And surprisingly, it doesn't cost a lot of money, but you have to put a little effort into it. You have to do a little planning. Kind of like I mentioned, fortunately, my wife had a will. If she did not have a will, then I would have been into another world of hurt. Mm-hmm. And so I think that planning has been very important. And then, as I mentioned with Dee Dee Hirsch, I find my volunteer work, helping with suicide survivors, helping them understand how to navigate through their crisis and through their disaster, it's very personally gratifying for me, because I'm able to work with, and I work with a trained therapist. And so the two of us go through this. So we have the person who's you know, clinically trained on mm-hmm. how to deal with grief and how to deal specifically with suicide. And then we have a person like me who's been through this. And to my fortuitous luck, I have positively been able to navigate my way through this maze. So I've come out of the other end, and I feel I have a very healthy, balanced lifestyle. I still work very hard, mm-hmm. but I'm much more attuned to balancing my life and making sure that my personal mental health and my physical health is in top performance, so I can do the other things in my life that I want to achieve.
You know, I hear this so often, and it's just one of those things that people say a lot, but you really have to take it to heart. And having you share your story about how that has helped you get through things and be resilient and be healthy in the midst of all this is just testament to that. And sometimes people just let it sort of go in one ear and out the other, but it's like you said, if you're not, that's when the depression might come in. If you get idle in the house, alone, those kind of things. So, yeah, I think that's great that you're sharing your experiences and how you're able to stay healthy and balanced. Really important. You also run a podcast, Risk Stories, right? So tell us a little bit about that.
So I wanted to create this podcast to focus mm-hmm. on risk. And there's mm-hmm. lots of different kinds of risk. I mean, I'm a technology nerd guy, and I love talking about IT disaster recovery and business resiliency as it relates to technology areas. But there's a lot of other kinds of risk out there in the world. In fact, my very first podcast episode, which was kind of rough because I was still trying to figure out how to do a podcast, I did it with a woman who's a friend of mine out of the United Kingdom, who also has experienced loss of suicide. And the two of us spent about a half hour, 40 minutes talking about mental health and things that people can do. And she had some really great suggestions and really great things that she does with her colleagues in the United Kingdom. And I thought in Europe, and I thought that was really great getting that different mm-hmm. perspective than we have in the United States. But we talk about other risk. I had a woman who's a former CIA analyst who was stationed in Iraq mm-hmm. as well as in Washington, D.C. So she talked about her experiences chasing bad people around the world.
Right.
I have a gentleman, he runs a company called Global Guardian, and he's an ex-special forces person. And he his company now started with executive detail protection. So protecting the senior executives at Starbucks, for example, from mm-hmm. kidnappings or extortion or cyber threats wow. or something like that. Well, he's expanded his business. So when you're traveling around the world and something happens, you push the red button or your phone goes off the grid, and he has people in 100 countries around the world that will go find you and extricate you out of the country. And he's talking about his adventures of, I'm tracking someone in an airport in Tel Aviv waiting to get clearance to take off so we can get them out safely and do it in such a way so they can actually re-enter the country when they leave. And he talks about fun stories of getting people out of countries and guns and things like that. And I just put the finishing touches on my latest podcast, which is from a climate expert. And this is a woman, she's out of Australia, and she used to be with Greenpeace, and she has spent her whole life with environmental climate issues. And she tells this great story. When she was at Greenpeace, she was the media communications director for Greenpeace for a number of years back in the 80s, 90s timeframe. And she tells this great story about how Greenpeace almost got a nuclear warhead from a few people defecting from the Soviet Union around the time that Mikhail Gorbachev's power was ending. And she says, we were within days of getting this nuclear warhead, and then these people just disappeared.
Wow. This is an exciting podcast. I'm going to have to refer my folks, especially IT and everyone who's the CTOs who are trying to mitigate risk for their companies. This could be really gripping stories. So why don't you tell our listeners how they can reach you or how they can reach your podcast too?
Sure. So the best way is either they can just go through LinkedIn, mm-hmm. M. Poldy. They can email me at michael@poldypartners.com. Or if they go to my website, which is poldypartners.com, there are links to our Risk Stories podcast and some of the other cool risk mitigation strategies that we deploy throughout the world.
Excellent. I'll make sure to have those on our show notes as well, so you can go in and get links there as well. Well, Michael, you have been just immensely helpful to share your story of, I say resilience, tragedy, and how you've gone through it from a nerd perspective too, and also sharing a great resource of your risk stories too. So thank you so much for being a guest on Reinventing Nerds.
Thank you, Joni. It's been a lot of fun.
Yeah, this has been great. And thanks to all our listeners and viewers. And don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review. And we'll see you next time.
We hope you enjoyed today's episode of Reinventing Nerds and encourage you to apply what you learned to help you communicate better. For a free consultation with Joni to see how she can help you further, please visit reinventingnerds.com. Until then, embrace your inner nerd and remain true to yourself while you develop your communication strategies.